You know, I came in with the expectation that I would work in a bipartisan way as much as humanly possible because my district is, you know, it's very evenly split. We've talked about this before. But I've found that that's simply harder to do than, you know, it's not as easy as just walking across the literal aisle and saying, like, hey, do you want to work on this thing?
California Congresswoman Katie Hill reflecting on her first 6 months on the job. We'll hear more from her later in the show. First, let's pick back up with our interviews with the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates. Today, Julian Castro. He served as the former secretary for the Department of Housing and Urban Development under President Obama. Before that, he was mayor of San Antonio. Castro is promising big changes to the immigration system, and he's one of the only candidates with a detailed plan to address homelessness. He's struggling to get noticed, though, in a crowded field. I spoke with him earlier today. Julian Castro, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You are well-versed in housing policy, having run HUD, and you were a mayor. And as you know, Los Angeles has a major homeless problem. What should LA be doing that it's not right now?
I would start by saying that the voters of Los Angeles, a good amount to be proud of in terms of an effort that has been made with propositions that were passed within the last few years to dedicate more resources to homelessness. I would continue to do that to create a greater supply of affordable housing and the supportive services that are needed to keep people off the streets once we find housing for them. In addition to that, you need to involve everybody. The federal government has a role to play. I've put out a housing plan that calls for much greater investment to end homelessness by 2028. So what Los Angeles ought to be doing is what it is doing, investing its own resources, working with the state to invest more resources, and putting pressure on the federal government to make the investments in the Los Angeles community to drive down every type of homelessness, whether it's veteran homelessness, chronic homelessness, youth homelessness, family homelessness.
So in 9 years, you will end homelessness. That's what you're promising?
That's my plan, yeah.
And so everybody will have a house or a place to live if they want one?
Yeah, everybody would have a safe, decent, affordable place to live. And, you know, I know when some folks hear that, they think, what in the world are you talking about? That's only 9 years away. But in the Obama administration, in 2010, President Obama released a blueprint for ending homelessness called Opening Doors. And it wanted to start with veteran homelessness. And between 2010 and 2016, we reduced veteran homelessness by 47%. Because the administration had a vision, it worked in a coordinated way with its departments, 19 different departments, working with governors, working with mayors across the country. And this is very significant, Congress actually functioned like it should. So everything worked in alignment. Everything worked like it should. If we do that, then I'm confident that we can end homelessness within a decade in our country.
But arguably, the veteran homelessness problem was significantly solved because they were put at the head of the line. There's only so much housing and only so many spots. And so some people are going to give when they get preference, other people will not. So how do you end it for everybody?
Well, I mean, it means that you have to make a huge investment in supply also. And that's why my plan also calls for instance, expanding the low-income housing tax credit by $4 billion. It calls for a $40 billion investment in the National Housing Trust Fund, $5 billion investment in the Capital Magnet Fund, which deals with public housing. So I don't disagree with you in terms of that, you know, if everything just stayed the same, we don't have enough units right now to meet that demand. We need to increase the number of units even as we work to end homelessness.
But part of it, or most of it, would have to do with the private sector. The fact here in Los Angeles is housing is very expensive. And how would you incentivize developers and neighborhoods? That is the key, at least here in Los Angeles. There's a lot of neighborhood opposition to building dense housing. How would you incentivize these groups to build more, build affordable, and build quickly?
There are different ways. We can be creative. For instance, one of the things the VA started looking at was the ability to build housing on its premises, on its property. I think that other governmental entities, there's a lot of governmental land out there right now that could have housing on it. That's one creative way. Another is that I believe, and you know, I was glad to see that others running have called for this, that we should make some of our federal grants more contingent on cities adopting land use that makes it easier to develop housing that's affordable to the middle class and to working poor and the poor.
Do you think Mayor Garcetti could do more on that score to really requisition city-owned property, or at least use the bully pulpit to overcome NIMBYism?
Well, I mean, I think he's done a lot. When I was HUD secretary, he and Bill de Blasio were the two mayors that I talked to more than anybody else that were interested in, hey, look, how can we work together? What funds do y'all have available? You know, can you make this investment in Los Angeles? So I know from personal experience that he's been very, very involved in fighting for more resources for Los Angeles.
Bill de Blasio is running for president. Do you think he'd make a good president?
I think he'd make a much better president than Donald Trump. That is for sure.
Better than you?
Well, if I thought that, I wouldn't be running for president.
Let's talk about immigration. Your breakout moment in the debate was on immigration, and you have laid out a plan that calls for decriminalizing crossing the border illegally. So that would require you to pass a bill in Congress, a divided Congress. How would you get that through?
Great question. And you could apply that question to anything, right? I mean, healthcare, getting to universal healthcare, doing what we want to do on education, universal pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds. Look, I think that on January 20th, 2021, we're going to have a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate. And the lesson that we learned from 93 and 94 and 2009, 2010 is don't wait on impactful legislation. And so I would make a strong move right away on the most important things that we need to do, including healthcare and immigration. And if that means choosing between going forward with important immigration reform to fix our broken system or adhering to a 60-vote filibuster rule that is nowhere in the Constitution and that both parties have abused at different times when it's politically convenient, then I would choose actually getting something done to fix our broken immigration system. And also, that applies to healthcare. I would choose improving our healthcare system, getting to universal healthcare.
So universal is Medicare for all?
I believe that that we should have Medicare available to everybody. But if somebody has a private health insurance plan that they want to hold on to, then I believe they should be able to do that.
And how is that not a two-tier system?
Well, I mean, I do think that it gives folks both options. And I believe that we can get there. I also believe that just because somebody is poor or they don't have much money doesn't mean that they shouldn't be able to get the health care that they need and the medication that they need when they need it.
So I'm wondering if you feel that by calling for decriminalizing immigration, by calling for impeaching President Trump, which you have, by calling for Medicare for all, that you are calling for things that are appealing to the liberal base of the party, but will not be appealing necessarily in a general election. Were you afraid at all during the debate that you may have scared off potential moderate voters who might be attracted to your message otherwise?
Not at all. Look, I think politics is a combination of things. Number one, I think in this day and age, people understand that they're not going to agree with you on everything. I mean, look at the people that you talk to about Trump. They say, oh, I don't like it, what he tweets on Twitter, or I don't like this or that, but a lot of them are still supporting him. So I believe that sometimes people are going by an out-of-date, old-fashioned notion of how politics works today. What people want to know today is that you have a strong vision for the future of the country, and they may not agree with every part of that vision, but that you know what you're doing, that you're being genuine, you're not lying to them, and you know, that where you want to take the country generally fits with what they want the country to be. And I believe that there may be some people that disagree with me. I'm sure there are. Some Democrats that disagree with some parts of what I've proposed. But I think overall that I've presented a very compelling vision for the future of our country to become the smartest, the healthiest, the fairest, and the most prosperous nation on earth in the 21st century.
Well, how do you distinguish yourself from the pack of other Democrats who have very similar ideas? You're still polling around the 2 to 4% range. So how do you break ahead and take on an Elizabeth Warren or a Kamala Harris or a Joe Biden?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, I'm one of the few candidates that has strong executive experience. On top of that, I've been fearless in this campaign. I haven't been afraid to take on, you know, subjects that others have, whether
like
it's on
what?
Immigration or police reform is a good example of that. I've been very clear that I don't think that all of these videos that we keep seeing, I mean, how many videos do we have to watch before we understand that even though we have some great police officers in our country, this is not a case of just a few bad apples, that the system is broken. And we need more transparency and accountability for law enforcement so that they don't treat so many young black men, especially, differently from the way they treat others. I was also the first to take on the issue of immigration and to do it in a bold way with a very different vision from this president. I'm not afraid of that he's going to make it seem like I just want open borders. Basically, he is gambling. He's betting on fear and paranoia and a cruelty that he's demonstrated. And I'm betting that whether you're white or black or Latino or Asian American, you're rich or poor, whether you live in a big city like L.A. or you live in some small town in Iowa, that common sense and compassion are stronger.
Given the situation in places like Honduras and El Salvador, which are pretty much verging on lawlessness, lawless failed states, you could make an argument as someone who is coming here seeking asylum that everybody deserves asylum because they are fleeing this epidemic of violence in their own countries. Do you think that most people who come across the border have credible asylum claims and should be let in based on those claims?
I think that a lot of the people that are coming here do have a credible claim. Do I think that everybody who comes here is going to get asylum? No. But I do believe, for instance, that we should consider whether somebody is fleeing from gang violence or domestic violence, that we should consider that in terms of when they make their asylum claim.
But would you let most of them who are asking to come in, given what you've seen?
That's always going to be a call that is made on an individual basis by a judge. Of course, there are also concerns that we have in the United States we have to make sure that the number of people that are granted asylum, the number of refugees that we bring in, that there's an orderly way that we do that. I have never said that everybody who applies is going to be able to get asylum or to stay in the country. But I do agree, I do believe that a lot more people should be allowed in.
Would you meet with Kim Jong-un as President Trump has done?
Yeah, I believe in reaching out and meeting with our adversaries. The mistake that I believe this president has made is that he was not prepared for any of the summits that they've had. And I think that it's a mistake to continue to deal with a dictator like that if he hasn't lived up to his commitments, which is the case here.
And what about Iran? It's now enriching uranium. What would you do?
I would work with our allies to put economic pressure, sanctions, strengthen those on Iran to get them back into the compliance with the Iran nuclear agreement, and then work to get either a revised agreement or back into the original agreement, because you know, countries around the world and here in the United States, it was acknowledged that that Iran nuclear agreement was the strongest agreement that had ever been put in place, with the strongest monitoring provisions to make sure that a country could not develop a nuclear weapon. And then this administration went in there with no plan, and it tore that agreement up. And if folks think about it, if you're Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump is coming to you and saying, hey, let's make a deal, like, why in the hell would you believe him when he just tore up an agreement with Iran that everybody acknowledged was a strong agreement? He's too erratic. He wants to create chaos and then be the hero. The problem is that he doesn't have the capacity to actually solve that problem. He just makes a mess. It's time for a president that has the ability to provide a solution, and I do.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
That's former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro, one of nearly two dozen Democrats running for president in 2020. Coming up, 6 months in, is being a member of Congress all it's cracked up to be? An assessment from California freshman Democrat Katie Hill, next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, back in January, Press Play producer Michelle Alloy headed to Washington to follow two of California's newly elected lawmakers during their first week on the job. The two Katies, Katie Hill from Santa Clarita and Katie Porter from Irvine, both Democrats who ousted longtime Republican incumbents. Well, Michelle caught up with both of them recently to see how things are going 6 months in. Today, we'll hear from Katie Hill.
You've been in Congress now for about 6 months.
Yes.
What's been the biggest adjustment for you in terms of like what you expected the job to be and how it actually ended up being?
I feel like I didn't have a set of expectations going in. I knew that we were going to be working on these massive problems that are affecting people across the country and people right at home. I knew that it was going to be insanely busy. So I guess I was ready for a lot of things to be thrown at me. And I think that's certainly been the case. One thing that I think has been sort of surprising is, you know, I came in with the expectation that I would work in a bipartisan way as much as humanly possible because my district is, you know, it's very evenly split. We've talked about this before. But I've found that that's simply harder to do than, you know, it's not as easy as just walking across the literal aisle and saying like, hey, do you want to work on this thing? Because even if you do, even if you talk to somebody about it, even if they seem to share the same kind of, you know, beliefs or ideas around it, it's very hard to get somebody to openly do something without the kind of consent of their party or the fears of what their base might do, especially in this environment where, you know, a lot of people on the Republican side are very concerned about being primaried or being disowned by Trump in some capacity. And so, I don't know, it's just been something that I've found a bit more disheartening. And I've also kind of realized that we're hitting a point where I believe that the change that's going to come to bring us back away from this hyperpartisanship is going to be a new generation of people who are intentionally moving us away from that. And
on the Republican side or the Democratic side or both?
Both. And so, for example, the younger folks that I'm talking about, the newly elected Republicans, too, they're much more inclined to want to work across the aisle or to share some of the same beliefs. Like, we're not going to be on the same page about everything, but there are a lot of things that we can find common ground about. But it is just simply, there are some things, you know, if it comes down to equality or if it comes down to a woman's right to choose, like, I'm not bending on that.
We'll talk a little bit more about, you know, this concept of working across the aisle, because I think a lot of citizens think that it is just as easy as walking across and saying, hey, let's find an issue that we can work together on. Certainly, Vice President Joe Biden is running on that very idea. Mm-hmm. But you're saying that that's, frankly, sounds like not possible.
I wouldn't say it's not possible, but I would say it's definitely harder than you might think. An example, let me talk about a couple of things that we are doing that are bipartisan. One of them is here in Los Angeles. We've really redone so much around our foster care system and our youth juvenile justice system because of something called the Title IV-E waiver. Well, that waiver is about to expire. And it's a bipartisan effort for those of us in a number of different states to try and get this extended. So there are certainly topics that you can put aside, but there are some where it just doesn't seem to go anywhere. There will be one little hang up that you just can't bend on, but they won't either. And it's just a fundamental difference in values.
Because I was going to say, certainly the American, like those issues are important. But when people think about bipartisanship, they want to see that sort of reaching across the aisle on bigger issues like healthcare spending,
mm-hmm, exactly,
like prescription drug prices, gun control measures. And this continues. I mean, certainly the Democratic House has passed bills to that effect, but they go nowhere once they reach the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And so does the job feel sometimes futile in that sense?
I don't know about futile, because I feel like we're working towards something that is, it's ultimately a matter of time before a certain set of beliefs or an unwillingness to, you know, to embrace the idea of every single person having healthcare as a right, not a privilege. Like, that is overwhelmingly believed by the vast majority of people under a certain age. And so, you know, when you look at who supports which party and the ideology that sits within that, it's simply time is going to change things.
So I want to turn to one of the issues that's been really dividing Congress, and that is impeachment. Mm-hmm. At least 16 members of the California congressional delegation have called for it. You are not among them. Why?
So I have said that, first of all, I think when we're thinking about impeachment, we have to think about a few different things. The first is that our job in the House is to effectively be like a prosecutor, to lay out the case. And I don't feel like we've gone through the entire process of fully laying out that case for the American people. I think
what needs to be done? What needs to be laid out?
So, you know, we have the Mueller report that hardly anyone's read. I think it's super important that that he comes and testifies, and he's doing that soon. And that'll help to clarify some things. But I also think that, you know, we have different, potential impeachable offenses that we're going into within both the Oversight Committee, the Financial Services Committee, intelligence, and all of those need to be clearly shown to people that it's not, this is why this is an issue, right? This isn't just something we're making up because we want to remove Trump, because everyone in Congress is pretty well aware that whatever we do on the House side, I mean, you can see that the Senate won't even take up our legislation, let alone are they going to impeach the president. So what we have to do is be very deliberate so that if and when we do have to move to impeachment, it's not going to be a simple exoneration of the president when the Senate doesn't convict. I want to make sure that it is so clear to the public that the Senate is on the wrong side on this, that if they choose not to convict him, they need to be held as much accountable in the 2020 election as Trump himself. So that's part of it. The second part is, I think that, you know, really part of what we have to do is to show that we are being deliberate, that we are not rushing on this, right? That we are allowing this to go through the courts in the way that it has to. And I think that, you know, a lot of people are concerned that that's going to take too much time, or that if we get into next year, we're not going to be able to do anything with impeachment. I don't believe that to be the case at all. I think that when we reach that critical point, if we do, then, and, it, you know, frankly, I think that it's more and more likely that we do at some point, that we have to do it, right? It's not going to be like, oh, well, the election's just a few months away. No, I think it's that we have to do it. We have to say, this is why we're doing it. And I think the closer it is to the election, frankly, the harder it's going to be, because our case will be so solid, for the Senate to simply just say, no, it's fine. He's all good. My line that I've drawn in terms of when I will call for it is if he blatantly defies a court order. And just a couple days ago, when he said that after the census decision was made, and he was saying that, oh, well, we're going to do it anyway. And if that happens, if they do it anyway, despite of the Supreme Court ruling, then that is the definition of a constitutional crisis.
Well, and I guess he has said that he would potentially do this through executive
exactly.
order. So, I mean, is that a line then? If they do,
I mean, why do we even have those three branches of government? I had somebody tell me the other day, you know, when I was talking about this census issue, he's like, well, the Supreme Court ruled. He can't do anything about it. I'm like, yeah, the Supreme Court doesn't have a military. The Supreme Court doesn't have police. What keeps our system happening, keeps it, you know, working, is a simple mutual agreement of every party who's participating in it, saying that if the Supreme Court decides this, then you comply. And if he decides not to, which he's clearly been willing to do on so many other issues, then we really are in a constitutional crisis, as far as I'm concerned. And this could be the test of it.
So as you yourself start to look to re-election in 2020, you're already facing challenges from at least three people.
Five
at this point. Okay, so you're facing challenges
yes.
from five people
yes.
at this point. You know, I guess, what are the things that you are grappling with in terms of how to hold onto your seat and continue to sort of thread this needle between moderate and progressive?
Yeah, I would say that is really kind of the threading of the needle is one that I really have to keep going back to. Like, you know, people voted for me. I believe this truly. People voted for me because I said that I was going to vote my conscience and that I was going to vote in the way that I believed was what this community, what would serve this community the best. And so ultimately, I need to be able to explain that to people. I need to be able to say, this is the reason that I did what I did and kind of own up to the consequences. I will see if, you know, some of the things that I'm advocating for or voted on, how much that comes back to bite me. But I really believe that a lawmaker cannot and should not be making decisions based on their likelihood of getting reelected. And that's something that I believe from the bottom of my heart. And hopefully that doesn't make me a one-term member of Congress.
But what about, I mean, one person at least is trying to tie you to fellow Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and saying that you're not the moderate that you ran on.
So I would say that that's going to be the playbook for every single Democrat that's being challenged by a Republican in 2020, is that they are going to be compared to AOC. And I think that's where my work on the ground, what we're able to accomplish for the people within the district, that's what matters. That's what shows up. And, you know, ultimately the national attack ads are going to happen. And you have to be someone that your community knows and doesn't believe that about. Right. So when people see something like Katie Hill's a socialist and wants to, you know, I don't know, take away everything, then people will say that that's not the person I know.
Santa Clarita Congresswoman Katie Hill speaking with Press Play producer Michelle Aloy. We'll hear from Katie Porter later this week. Coming up, writers and agents are now suing each other. Is this the end of a beautiful friendship? How the dispute over packaging deals is dividing Hollywood. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and now our regular segment, TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you, treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, the battle between Hollywood writers and their agents is still raging. And as of July 1st, three major agencies, WME, UTA, and CAA, are suing the Writers Guild. They say the Guild is violating antitrust laws by organizing an unlawful group boycott. WGA is also accusing the agencies of violating antitrust law, including collusion and price fixing. Joining us with the latest is Jonathan Handel, entertainment and technology attorney and contributing editor to The Hollywood Reporter. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Okay, this is really confusing and complicated, or so it seems. Can you simplify it for us? Bring us up to speed. What are the agencies accusing the Guild of doing exactly?
The agencies are accusing the Guild of exceeding the boundaries of a limited exemption that unions have for under antitrust law. Now, what does that mean? If you think about what any union does, think about the steel workers or whatever, the nurses union, they set prices for labor. And sometimes they boycott an employer by saying if the employer won't sign on to the collective bargaining agreement, the union agreement. Both of those things would be an antitrust violation if it weren't for the fact that there is a specific exemption, actually two exemptions in antitrust law for the benefit of unions. What the agencies are saying is that in moving to a group boycott, as they put it, of the agencies, telling all the writers to fire their agents, that the Writers Guild has exceeded the boundaries of the exemptions that benefit the union.
So basically, you can't boycott more than one agency? Is that what they're saying?
No, it's very, with apologies, it's very in the weeds. It comes down to whether regulating packaging fees, the way that agents get paid by employers, by the studios, that whether that kind of regulation is a legitimate union goal or not. So what the agencies are saying here is that the union is really going too far in trying to regulate a business practice between the agencies and the studios, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to regulating wages, which of course is what a union does when they negotiate with management.
So basically the agencies are saying, union, you're poking your nose into something that's none of your affair. It's not really your business. This is our business with the studios. You just concentrate on what you're supposed to be doing, which is setting the price for writers.
That's right. Now, I think the Writers Guild is going to disagree with that, and is also going to say, look, whether we're under the law, whether we're right or wrong, is not actually the issue. The issue is, do we have a legitimate belief, a good faith belief, that we're right? So you can see from this that it gets very, very technical very quickly. And this is an area at the intersection of antitrust law and labor law. There aren't a lot of labor lawyers out there in the country anymore, as labor unions have declined. And then the intersection with an industry that has agents, which is really only entertainment and sports, you're talking about a very small amount of expertise and a very small number of decided cases. Hmm. There are only 3 federal cases in this area. And this is both stormy waters and completely uncharted seas, quite okay. frankly.
Yeah. And so we're going to hear from some writers in a few minutes about what they're saying the agencies are doing. But in general, if you could step back a little bit, and I know this, we are, as you say, in uncharted waters. Where does this go from here? Is this going to drag on for many more months? And how does this affect production?
Well, I think it will drag on. And there's another element here, which is that the Writers Guild has said, yeah, there's an antitrust problem here, but it's not with us. It's with the agencies. The agencies have been bargaining jointly through their trade association, the Association of Talent Agencies, which was fine with the Writers Guild, until a week or two ago when they said, you know what, now we only want to bargain with you individually. And guess what? We are hereby telling you that if you continue to try to bargain jointly, or even try to coordinate through your Association of Talent Agents, that you guys, the agents, will be violating antitrust law because you'll be illegally coordinating your responses to us. And the Writers Guild may well be right on that. And so amazingly, they are pulling the rug out from under the entire negotiating structure that the agents have been engaged in.
Wow. So that would sideline this Association of Talent Agencies if they prevail. And then each individual talent agency would have to bargain with the Writers Guild?
That's exactly right. And so that, to answer your earlier question, that is a formula for this just dragging on and on. The law gets more and more complicated. The author of a 10-volume treatise, the definitive treatise on antitrust law, when I asked for comment on this, he didn't say he wouldn't comment. He said, I can't comment, which indicates to me he's already been retained as an expert by one side or the other. Hmm. This is lawyering up to the skies.
Well, so meanwhile, what does this mean for actual production?
Well, so far, not a lot of effect on production, but I think it increases the likelihood that we are going to see this drag on into next year's negotiations with the studios between the various unions and in particular the Writers Guild as their contracts expire. And I think that there is an increasing likelihood that the Writers Guild negotiations will be very difficult and could result in a strike, an actual strike.
This is a separate situation, or is this wrapped up into the same thing?
It's wrapped up into the same thing. I think what the Writers Guild is going to say to the studios is the money that you used to, that you planned on paying in packaging to the agencies, you're not going to be paying that because there is no packaging. We fired we all fired our agents. We want that money for the lower level rank and file who have been suffering, according to the Writers Guild, have been suffering wage stagnation. That's going to be a very challenging negotiation.
Okay. Jonathan Handel, entertainment and technology attorney and contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's hear from two writers now. Edden Dranger, she's a TV writer for an upcoming show called The Unicorn. It's on CBS. Hi there.
Hi.
And joining me in the studio, David Slack, show creator, executive producer, and board member of the Writers Guild. Hi, David.
Hi.
All right, let's pick up where Jonathan left off and this idea of a possible strike next year. Is that something you're discussing, David?
Look, in any labor negotiation, everything's on the table, but that's not something you necessarily plan for. So I don't know that the situation we're in right now has any effect one way or another on what's going to be happening in our 2020 negotiation a year from now.
Right. Okay. So how would you characterize the negotiations at this point?
With what was the ATA?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're doing something that 6 months ago people said was impossible, and now we're in the middle of doing it. So, you know, it's not an easy thing to take on. We're talking about changing the way business is done and dealing with some pretty entrenched interests. But it's existential. Mid-level writers' income dropped 23% in the last 5 years, and there are a number of factors for that. But One of them is that as we moved over to cable and streaming, there are things that our members weren't being protected against, and they weren't being protected in areas of overscale income, which is the part of our income that is delegated to the agencies to negotiate. So in 2014 and 2017, the Writers Guild, for the first time in our history, had to negotiate writers' overscale income.
Okay, wait, stop, because the average person has
really
no
into
idea
the weeds.
What you're talking about. What does that mean exactly?
Agents have the right to represent writers because the Writers Guild of America grants them the right to represent writers. That's what we're negotiating, is our franchise agreement. We franchise them to negotiate for us. What we franchise them to negotiate for us, like NBA players, is the part of our income that goes over the minimums, that goes what we call overscale. So scale is the minimums. That's what the Writers Guild negotiates. Mm-hmm. Overscale is the extra part that agencies negotiate, because writers of various levels have differing negotiating power. So we delegate that to them. And we have had some problems with areas in which our incomes have not been protected. Over the last 20 years, we're entering peak TV. Studios are doing great. Agencies are doing great. Our incomes are flat or falling.
And so, Eden, as a working writer, how has that affected you?
You know, when I first signed with my agency, I didn't know about packaging at all. And it was kind of shiny for them to put in, like, all these names that they wanted to attach them to my projects and everything. And I just thought, oh, this is kind of neat. But I didn't really make the connection. But, you know, when staffing season rolled around and this started going down, I realized other writers were kind of in the dark, too, and didn't know that this was going on. And I was sure that, you know, showrunners were not really talking to agents, especially because most showrunners are in solidarity with WGA. So I just was going into staffing season being like, well, I hope I know someone who knows someone. But luckily, you know, managers are still working and probably doing double duty this season. And my manager really stepped in, and I really owe it to my manager for really hustling and making the deal go through.
So basically, you know, your manager's really, acting like your agent.
Basically, yeah. I mean, she was doing all the heavy lifting and, you know, contacting executive producers just to get my script read and everything, and really pushing the showrunners to meet with me. She really just hustled. And I hope other managers, you know, did that too. But like, the thing is, we should be expecting that from our agents.
And so, you know? David, is that not, before this happened, were the agents not doing that?
You know, it varies agent to agent. But the problem, you know, the entire goal of this campaign is to realign our agents' financial incentives with our own. And one of the big bones of contention, there are two main issues here, which is packaging fees and producing. Packaging fees are a payment from the studios directly to the agency without any of their clients involved. And when you're getting paid directly by the people you're negotiating with, you're not super incentivized to negotiate the best rate for every writer, director, actor, and other creative professional you represent. Producing, which WMECAA and UTA have now started producing wings, in that instance, they become the entity that we're negotiating with. So
they have a conflict of interest.
They have a profound conflict of interest. And we see that borne out in our employment data and how much our writers are making.
So can you envision a future where you don't have agents anymore?
There are definitely people who are talking about that. I'm in a process right now of working to close a couple of deals that have come in since April so that I don't have to pay commission to anyone on them other than my attorney. But the goal of this has never been to remove agents from the equation. Agents can provide really valuable services. And when their incentives are correctly aligned with us, there can be an invaluable part of a writer's career. So this isn't about putting the producing entities out of business. It's not about putting the agencies out of business. It is simply about us negotiating with them what the terms are under which they can represent our members.
Hmm. So, and what about you? You said your manager is doing a great job. Can you see a future where you don't have your agent anymore?
I mean, like a lot of people, I really like my agents. You know, here's the thing. For younger, newer writers like myself, I think agents help. Representation in general helps to get the foot in the door. But if you're a high-level or even mid-level writer and you know producers and you know showrunners, they're not that essential as far as getting the job. I mean, there's, like, business things that I don't know and maybe writers don't know. And that's where, you know, I guess they could hire a lawyer. I really worry, though, about the younger, newer writers mm-hmm. because to my agent's credit, I didn't get my great manager without my agent. She really introduced me. And, you know, I think they really did work together very well. I would love to still have my agent when this is all over.
But is there bad blood? Like, do you talk to her or him, your agent?
Oh, my agent? Absolutely. We text all the time. But, you know, we have to do what we have to do. You know, I still like her as a person. You know, it's not really them. We're not targeting people specifically. It's not personal. This is all business. And, you know, now with WME becoming public, they're just huge, huge businesses. And it's not about one person in particular, one agent. It's not about that. It's about what they do and how much money they're taking away from us.
David, what about what she said about how this is going to maybe harm young writers or writers trying to get into the game?
That's a legitimate concern. You know, people at my level have connections and are able to proceed. We've, the Writers Guild, both as an entity and our members, have taken a lot of steps to try to help our most vulnerable members through that. There's been an enormous focus on this. We built the staffing submission system, which allowed writers to submit their work directly to showrunners without a middleman. We're now rolling out a similar system for TV and feature development that will let people submit themselves for open writing assignments and set general meetings. We've held mixers, both that were organized by the Guild and that were organized by our members. It's a tricky moment. We're doing everything we can to get everyone through it with as little damage as possible. But, you know, this is a union collective action. It's not a strike formally, but union collective actions don't come without risk. And there's always a cost to pay. The writers for I Love Lucy gave up their residuals so that I could have my health and pension plan. Part of being a union is being willing to make sacrifices. That said, we're doing what we can to try to make those sacrifices as small as possible, particularly for our most vulnerable members.
David Slack, he's a show creator, executive producer, and board member of the Writers Guild. And we also heard from Eden Dranger, TV writer, for an upcoming show called The Unicorn on CBS. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Steve Chiotakis, tell us. What's coming up at 1?
You know, oddly enough, just a couple of weeks ago, you know who Lucy Jones is, right?
Of course. She's a celebrity.
She's like a seismological celebrity in Southern California. She and I went out to go fault searching in the Altadena area.
Going tornado chasing?
It was kind of like that. It was amazing. And then, of course, a couple of strong earthquakes happened last week, and then she was once again catapulted into celebrity-dom. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, she is.
So we're going to play this interview, and it's actually really cool. We go fault searching. We talk about how you will probably survive the big one here in Los Angeles. But will Los Angeles survive the big one?
Wow. There is a question.
Because it's a big one. It's a big one.
In an enigma.
An enigma.
Thank you very much, Steve Chiotakis, Greater LA. Check it out. It's at 1 o'clock. Coming up, a single, solitary Sklar brother joins us to talk about the Clippers' big get and American women ruling the world, the soccer world at least. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for another sports update.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Well, Kawhi Leonard's last-minute decision to join the Clippers over the Lakers or the Raptors. Well, that left a lot of sports fans saying, Kawhi.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Hi, Madeline. It's Randy.
Hi, Randy Sklar. Minus the Jason.
Minus Jason. That's okay. I don't need him. He's dead weight. Just kidding. He's back in St. Louis with his family, with my mom. But I will carry the torch for us. A lot going on. There's so much going on.
On both of your shoulders. I know. Well, let's talk about Kawhi Leonard first.
Amazing.
Is that a good move? On both parts?
So here's why I'm going to say it's a good move. This is what I was hoping would happen. Either he would go back to Toronto, but that wasn't likely because he really wanted to come home. I think it's better for the NBA. So on the Sunday night before, like when free agency kind of all started, really around the 30th of June and then the 1st and then the 2nd, all these teams made great upgrades. Like teams like the Utah Jazz picked up like three guys out of nowhere, and you're like, okay, the Utah Jazz were pretty good last year, and now they might have bumped themselves up into the top of the Western Conference. And of course, you know, the Lakers got Anthony Davis from the Pelicans, but the Pelicans did really well in the draft, and they did really well in free agency, and Indiana did well. And
okay, but with every game,
so
there's
all
a loss,
of that,
right?
There's a loss. There's a little bit of loss, but players got shifted. Boston lost guys, but gained guys and got better. And so you say to yourself, the biggest winner was Brooklyn because they got Kevin Durant mm-hmm. from the Golden State Warriors and they got Kyrie Irving. So they got these two massive players and they already had a good Brooklyn and the Clippers were very similar. A lot of young, no-name guys who are actually playing really well. They both made the playoffs but exited in the first round. But they both cleared out cap space so they could bring in a Kawhi, bring in a KD, and bring in a big player. So they were great programs, good front offices, good coaches, perfect situations for big name
players.
Okay,
I'm waiting for
the
butt.
So then there was a moment where you were like, Kawhi could go to the Lakers. And if he goes to the Lakers, he's with LeBron. He's with Anthony Davis.
Yes.
And suddenly that team becomes the runaway favorite to win it all. And all the parity that was created by this wonderful free agency would have been lost. But he goes to the Clippers instead. And now we
this
in the same building. It's high
serious
drama.
Chess moves
right?
you're talking
so
about.
Not only does Kawhi go to the Clippers, but Paul George, who was a fantastic player, great two-way guy, great scorer, great defender. He's really one of the best two-way guys in the NBA, top 10 player. He was playing for Oklahoma City. Now, Paul George got traded to Oklahoma City a couple years ago from Indiana. And at the end of his year, he was just on a small contract. He was a free agent. Everyone thought, oh, he's coming to L.A. because he's from the L.A. area. No, he goes back to OKC, which shocked everybody that he signed a multi-year deal with OKC. Kawhi Leonard contacted KD first. This is what rumor has it. Mm-hmm. Kevin Durant said, will you come and play with me in the Clippers or the Lakers? Will you come and play with me? And KD said, no, I'm going to Brooklyn. So then he contacted Paul George through his people and whatnot and said, if they made a trade, the Clippers made a trade, would you come play with me? And Paul George said yes. So now the Clippers have Paul George, who is really one of the best players in the league, and Kawhi Leonard, who is arguably the best player in the league.
This is like Game of Thrones.
It is. And so now you've got – and then you've got LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and they made a couple of nice pickups in that they got Danny Green.
My question is, will the Clippers now win?
The Clippers have a great shot to win. I don't think
that's
it's set in stone.
Know.
They have a great shot to win. They made the playoffs last year, and they didn't have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Now they've got these two amazing players. Kawhi is in all – he's a fantastic team player. I don't think even Kawhi knew what he was going to do until the very end. He's a very strange individual. There's a rumored story that when he was with the San Antonio Spurs, they all went out for a team dinner, and they all ordered dinner. And instead of ordering dinner, he pulled out a bag of 12 apples and ate all of them at the dinner. Now – no one can predict that was going to happen at a restaurant.
12?
Right, 12 apples, ate them all, a dozen apples. And so, look, that's good, and he's in great shape as a result of it, but sometimes you got to order the meal that's there. I don't know if that made the waiter feel good or not, but he doesn't care. He just does what he wants to do. He brought a championship to Toronto. He brought a championship to the Spurs. He was series MVP in both. He could bring a championship to the Clippers, which has always been the second run or, you know, organization here in town. So it is so exciting.
I should say. Okay, yeah, that's exciting. So that and the Nets, you know, and the Knicks.
The Nets are good. The Knicks kind of had a terrible, they were terrible. But the Nets will be good. So the whole league now it's wide open. There's about 7 or 8 teams that could win it all, which is exciting.
Okay, you're very excited.
I'm very excited because I think it could have been worse.
How excited were you to watch the Home Run Derby?
Home Run Derby is like the slam dunk competition. It has actually become even more exciting at times than the actual All-Star game. The All-Star game at times can be, we got to get this guy in, mm-hmm. and we got to get this guy from this team in, and all these people are injured, so we're getting guys who weren't really voted in, but we expect. So it feels like it's a bit of anticlimactic, whereas the Home Run Derby is exciting.
Yeah.
So last night, two rookies. First of all, Jacques Peterson. I love him. And not just because he's Jewish. Jacques Peterson of the LA Dodgers.
It's not spelled Jacques, by
it's
the way.
It's Jacques.
Just Jacques.
Jacques. Okay. He's a Jacques. He actually had an unbelievable first round and swatted, I believe, 21 home runs, maybe? 24. He had an unbelievable first round, and he fought tooth and nail against a rookie, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., whose father won it in 2007. Vladimir Guerrero Sr. The junior is just a young dude who just swings so hard, right-hander, just was jacking the ball way out. And the exit velocity was incredible, like way over 110 miles per hour. He's just launching these balls. And he just got tired in the end. And in the end, Pete Alonso, who's a rookie for the Mets, he won it all. And so you had two rookies in the champ. That is great for the sport. The Mets haven't had a guy win the Home Run Derby since Daryl Strawberry co-won it in the 80s. So
Darryl
this has been
Strawberry,
a long time. I know,
awesome
we're talking
pass.
A long time. So it was very exciting and very cool. It went down. There was some,
You have seconds to go.
I know.
You're getting it in.
There's
quickly.
So much to talk about.
All right.
So it was
will the women finally get equal pay, the soccer?
No, stars. Actually, I don't believe in equal pay. I think that until the men win anything, they should be paid less than the women.
Excellent.
That's me.
Okay, I like that.
They won't,
great.
But I wish they should.
You'll never be invited back on the show.
No, come on, all U.S. right. soccer. Pay the women
Finally,
what they deserve.
Tell your Julian Castro joke, because you did advise him before the debate.
Yeah, if you heard me on heard us on This American Life, we okay. did advise him. My joke is a joke that he did not use. I said, if you don't impeach Trump, if you really want to get back him, just make him a member of Amy Klobuchar's staff. Boom!
Ooh!
Zing! He didn't
it's
use it.
So crazy that he didn't use that.
Well, of course he wasn't going to use that, but we made his staff laugh, and that was really the whole point of it.
Okay, go back and listen to This American Life and check out the Sklar brothers offering their jokes to Julian.
It was a blast, and he's a good dude.
All right, Randy Sklar, one half, the better half
thank
of
you.
The Sklar brothers, and I say that when you're not here.
Oh,
Jason,
thank
by
you.
The way. Check out their sports podcast. It's called View from the Cheap Seats. And that's it for us. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.